Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, clinician in rabbit, exotic animal and wildlife medicine and surgery, Bronwyn Cotterwas. Thank you, Bronwyn. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Great. Thanks for having me today and everyone for joining us on this webinar for treatment of unusual mammal pets, whether you're listening live or you're tuning in recorded. Hopefully you'll find this helpful. When I was trying to figure out what unusual pets to talk about, it was a little bit difficult. There's quite a variety out there, but I've chosen a number that I think are really important, not only to know some anatomical differences, but also some husbandry differences so that you'll be best prepared to approach veterinary consultation with as much success as possible. So we've decided to talk about tenrecs, sugar gliders, chipmunks, and prairie dogs. Hopefully you know what all of these are. If not, the tenrec is the hedgehog-looking thing. But they're all unique in their own different ways and have seem to have kind of caught on in some form or another as a different kind of exotic pet to have. So we'll run through with each of them a little bit about their background, some important husbandry details, certainly how to handle them so that you can stay safe, and then specific health concerns that each of these different types of animals might have. And then we'll kind of combine all of them, and in general we'll chat about IV access and those kind of important things, as well as touch on anesthesia. So starting with the tenrec, they are pretty cute little things. They do look like African pygmy hedgehogs, but they're not a hedgehog at all, really. They're more related to shrews. They're a member of the insectivore family. The pet tenrec is also known as the lesser hedgehog tenrec. Native to Madagascar and mainland Africa, they're primarily nocturnal and solitary animals as well, although you will have owners coming into your practice that have a number of them. Perhaps they have a breeding pair. They really tend to be solitary, and so housing them on their own is absolutely fine. Tenrecs in the wild, well, like a lot of our exotic pets in the wild, don't live quite as long as in captivity, but you can see their lifespan is really quite long, 7 to 19 years. I think the reports of them tend to be more in the 10 to 15 year range, but that'll be, quite a good lifespan for a little exotic species. Again, there can be a lot of variation with when they reach sexual maturity based on how intensive their husbandry is. So in the wild, they might reach sexual maturity later on, whereas in captivity, where they've got lots of good food and housing, they might reach that earlier. Gestation can be quite long, and they're also with the most prolific insectivore species. They have really, really large litter sizes, up to 32, with an average of 15, luckily. But if you have a client who has breeding pairs of tenrecs, you should make sure you advise them on how large the litter sizes can be and that they're prepared to handle that number of animals. And then they're weaned at about just around a month of age. It'll be important to be able to tell the differences between male and female tenrecs. The males have this lighter patch around their eyes once they reach sexual maturity. It's kind of a hairless patch, so it won't be obvious when they're younger. Even, when owners are going to buy their pet tenrecs, it might not be obvious whether they're buying a male or female. And indeed, if they want a breeding pair, they might not know what they have. So tenrecs sometimes are passed on to new owners a little bit older when they've reached sexual maturity, so that owners are sure that they've got a male or a female. And you can see the photo on the left is the male with the lighter coloring around his eyes, the periorbital area, or the little hairless patch, and the female on the right just has a normal hair and normal coloring in that area. Some really important anatomical differences with these insectivores. First of all, they don't have a cecum. That really won't affect you in your outward examination, but if you are doing surgery on a tenrec or post-mortem on a tenrec, at least you'll know to expect that. They have really small eyes. You can see that kind of orbital aperture is just tiny. Obviously, they're nocturnal. They're meant for digging around and finding insects. They don't need their eyes, but their sense of smell and hearing are really, really well developed. They tend to have a lower body temperature, so don't panic if you take a temperature and think it's hypothermic. They do trend lower. And they do enter a torpor, or I suppose it'd be similar to like a brumation in reptiles, but a torpor is essentially when their metabolic rate slows down, not quite like hibernation. And tenrecs are a bit silly in that they can do it seasonally like other animals can in that September to February time, that typical winter time. Or they can do it daily depending on temperatures in the room or resources available. So that's something to make your owners aware of, that it's really important to have consistent husbandry with their tenrecs, consistent temperatures as well, so that they're not having this fluctuation of in and out of torpor. They have a cloaca, so a common opening of their urogenital systems, and so therefore no external signs of sex differentiation, which again is why it's so difficult to determine a male or a female tenrec until they're mature and then show that periorbital color changes. And then I've added in a dental formula. Again, it may not be important, but if you are doing a dental on them, you'll know what kind of teeth to expect. So a lot of teeth in that little mouth for eating lots and lots of insects. We come on to housing. I mentioned that they're a nocturnal species, and so your owner really, really needs to be aware where they're putting the enclosure for their tenrec, so they won't be disrupting the sleep of other house inhabitants. Also, they need to be aware, like I said before, that they are very sensitive to smells and sounds, so they'll need to be in a quieter area, certainly away from the kitchen, away from any entertainment room, just a nice quiet room, or even ideally and purpose-built outdoor, perhaps a little shed or an aviary that they can keep quiet, clean, and warm for them. Tenrecs tend to be diggers. They'll root around in the bedding or the litter, so they're not really much climbers. So you can have a smoothed wall enclosure, which will make it easy to clean and keep your hygiene as optimal as possible. Some kind of absorbent bedding is ideal, whether it's paper or sawdust that's low dust or shredded, little bits of shredded wood. There's lots and lots of litter out there. We tend to advise just paper because it's easy. It's easy to get. It's easy to get rid of and easy to clean. And doesn't tend to get into wounds or to cause problems. It's very, very important to provide a nest box for these species. They obviously, being nocturnal, they'll hide most of the daytime. And although they are a solitary species, you might find that they will congregate in their nest box together if they're group housed. So during their active time, they'll choose to not socialize with whoever's housed with them, but they might curl up together in their nest box and share that space when it's our daytime and their nighttime. When setting up their husbandry or their little enclosure, it's really important that the owners are aware that they do build latrines or create latrines, and oddly enough, they seem to do it near water, so they'll kind of form a toileting area near any water source, and that includes a water bottle actually. So the owner might want to have multiple water sources so that the tin wrecks aren't soiling their water supply and therefore becoming prone to disease. Temperature is really important to them. They're very sensitive to temperature fluctuations, as are a lot of our exotic species, really. But keeping them in about a 23 to 28 degree centigrade area is really, really important. So you probably have to advise providing a heat mat, ideally up the side of the enclosure, or being near a radiator, or what would be best really would be providing a heat lamp. It should also be a well-ventilated, dry, and draft-free area. We don't want these little ones to be overly humid. They can be a little bit prone to getting respiratory issues. So if it's a nice and dry area, that would be lovely. And finally, you can provide a dust bath for them. They love to dig and root around, and they do benefit from dust bathing. And that can be a typical chinchilla-style dust bath for them. You could do it two or three times a week, and they'll probably quite enjoy that. Moving on to diet, now you can imagine as insectivores, they have a pretty specialized diet. We tend to recommend high protein part of their diet being about 30 to 50%. A lot of that will be composed of a variety of insects and small vertebrates, so crickets, locusts, mealworms, waxworms. Obviously, we're going to try to go for the lower fat alternatives for that part of their diet. People also do offer commercial foods, typically a cat food, and ideally that would be a dry version of a cat food because they can be a bit prone to dental disease, and so providing dry food will just promote good dental health, hopefully prevent caries and build up of material in their mouth, and keep them from becoming obese as well. You know, as I mentioned, a small portion of their diet should be moderate fats. And then also offering them a little bit of fruit, some veg, and some leafy greens is fine as well, as long as it's just a small part of their diet. And definitely stay away from raw meat, eggs, and dairy. They won't be able to process that properly, and that could potentially make them prone to getting other diseases as well. On to handling, this will be important obviously when you want to examine your tin wreck in consultation. They can be well handled. Hopefully you'll have an owner who brings a tin wreck into consultation like this. Obviously it's been really well handled from a young age. It's bright and out and about. You can do a lot of the observation will give you clues to physical health and will go a long way to your clinical exam. So hopefully you can monitor your tin wreck or your animal when you have it in consultation and do a distant observation, but we'll need to get our hands on it as well. When it comes to that bit of actually getting your hands on it, they can stress really, really easily. You can imagine being a nocturnal species and being very sensitive to sounds and smells. Coming into our consultation room is going to just be a very stressful event for them. So if they do curl up like hedgehogs can, then you could potentially stroke them along the back. Just a little bit of gentle, really, really gentle bouncing to see if they'll uncurl. And you can try to stretch them as well. Hopefully you might have some kind of container that has come in that's clear or see-through that you can visualize the underside of the tin wreck or have a look at its quill health, its feet, its backside, its oral cavity without even needing to get your hands on it. But if you do need to get a little closer exam and it's trying to curl up, we have some tricks we can relay to you. So the astute of you out there might recognize this is actually an African pygmy hedgehog in this photo, not a tin wreck, but the same handling technique applies. If you're able to gently restrain the back limbs, then you can almost do kind of a wheelbarrow effect of the ten rack, and hopefully they'll stretch out for you, and you can monitor not only how they're moving around, their ambulation a little bit, but you can get a better, closer exam. More hands-on exams just really depend on the receptivity of the ten rack and how well it's handled. If you're lucky, you'll be able to sculpt, although the quills sometimes can get in the way of that and cause kind of secondary noises or referred noises. At least you'll be able to get a respiratory rate. Hopefully, you'd be able to get abdominal palpation and thoracic compression, and just a general outward exam. Anything else, if it's balled up, if it's not well handled, or for a further exam, you most likely will need to perform a little bit of a general anesthetic so you can do a thorough exam. Specific health concerns with TENREX, like I mentioned before, they can get periodontal disease, and that's typically diet related. So when they're on a softer food diet or a diet that's heavy in really fatty insects, then they'll be more prone to periodontal disease. And we treat that just as we do with any other animal. They can get malignant neoplasia. So just as is the case with African pygmy hedgehogs, we find that neoplasia tends to be a concern in TENREX, and that affects every system really, which is why I didn't list them all. It's pretty much a potential for any body system. Hepatic lipidosis is a really big concern given the propensity for fatty diets. So, owners hopefully will be monitoring body weight at home, and preventing obesity. And given, again, the small apertures of their eyes, they are and their desire to dig and root around so much, they are prone to getting eye disease also. So whether that's proptosis or corneal ulceration that's secondary to trauma, a bit of cellulitis in their periorbital area, all of these can happen, and it's expected for a species that's behaving in the way it does. So nothing unusual there. So that's been just a quick run through for TENREX. Hopefully that's given you some confidence for them if you see them in consultation. And we'll move on to the next species next, which is going to be sugar gliders. Again, a really lovely exotic species to look at. They're kind of the anime version of a squirrel, aren't they? But sometimes they're not the most malleable or tractable in consultation. So hopefully the tips on the next few slides will give you a hand in having a good consultation with them. So a bit of background, they are marsupials, so a lot of things that we need to think about differently with them. They have two lower incisors, where some marsupials just have a single one. The pet sugar glider that we tend to have in captivity is also known as the Australian gliding possum, and they are native to Australia. Again, like the TENREC, they're nocturnal, so we need to think about where we're housing them, away from noises during the day and away from their noises away from us at nighttime. But a little bit different from TENREX, they are social, so they do enjoy pair bonding or small groups of other sugar gliders about. They do have torpor as well, but it only lasts 3 weeks or so, and it's much milder than what you see in TENREX. They're a little bit hardier, so not as reactive. So it's typical to have a little bit of a seasonal torpor in sugar gliders. Just some quick details so you know what to expect. They, again, are longer lived than you might think originally, and this is because of how well we can keep them in captivity. Reaching sexual maturity at just about half a year to under a year of age. So it, again, it's very important to determine sexes in them so you can split up groups and have same sex groups if you're not wishing to breed them. Gestation is a little bit difficult to determine because as marsupials, obviously you won't be able to see the pouch young. They'll be in that pouch for quite a long time until you just see a little bit of a bulge. They tend to spend about 70 days in that pouch. Litter sizes tend to be about 2, so similar to small primates, and the pouch young wean themselves at about 4 months of age when they're ready to emerge. Luckily, male and female Tenrecs are a little bit easier to tell the difference between. This photo at the top is a female Tenrec, but male Tenrecs, you can see that stripe along the forehead going from head to nose. Male Tenrecs will have a bald spot right in the middle of that black stripe, so that will be an easy difference to tell. They also have more prominent glands. And then hopefully you'll be able to recognize that the female has a pouch, so a little bit easier than the Tenrecs. Other important anatomical differences, what obviously gives them their name, the sugar gliders, is their gliding membrane, which is a fold of skin that runs from their arms to their hind legs. It's also known as the patagium, so similar to what bats would have, but also obviously thicker and furred. Being a marsupial, they have a cloaca. So again, a common opening of the urogenital systems and intestinal tract, so no external sex determination there. Unique to marsupials is they have no ossified patellas, paired clavicles, and they also have kind of combined digits on their back feet. Sugar gliders specifically, both male and female, have 3 paracloacal glands. So these are for scent marking, but they can become impacted. The boys will be more pronounced than the females, certainly at breeding times of year as well. So when you're doing a physical exam, it would be a great idea to be able to investigate or at least identify these paracloacal glands. And I've put their dental formula in there as well, so you have an idea of what that might be. Another major anatomic difference, and this might help you decide, well, at least help you during surgery, is the females have a really unique reproductive tract. They not only have paired uteruses and cervices, but also 2 portions or a paired vagina. So they've got a median section of a vagina and a lateral section as well that kind of loops around like a bit of a pretzel. And the ureters for the bladder course from going from kidney to bladder course right between the 2. So this might make it difficult to perform a spay procedure or a variohysterectomy. You might choose to do just an ovariectomy in this species, given the unique anatomical differences here. In terms of housing, being a gliding species or a species that really is important for them to be climbing around and jumping around, you'll need to have a tall style cage, almost an aviary style, covering it with a cloth during the daytime so that they're not bothered, so that they get some rest. And vertical bars are a little bit better than mesh because they won't traumatize their toes themselves on it as they're climbing around. So if you can, opt for or advise a mesh cage with vertical bars. Just a simple substrate would be absolutely fine. Again, getting back to just shredded paper or similar. They root around a bit, but not as much as the Tenrecs, so they're much more interested in jumping from perch to perch and branches and maybe even swing similar to what birds would have would be ideal. Some owners are able to let them out into rooms to do a true glide as well. So if you've got a nice tractable sugar glider, hopefully it can get some outside time, well, outside of its cage time in a safe room, and have some chance to use its patagium. Nest box, again, important given that it's a nocturnal species. And the temperature should again be high, so 24 to 27 degrees Celsius. You might need to be providing or advising that your owners provide a heat lamp. Sometimes we're also advising UV in sugar gliders. We'll get on to that a little bit later, but they can be prone to metabolic bone disease, and we think that UV supplementation, even though they are a nocturnal species, might be a good idea, even just for a short period of time, for a day or 2 a week. Now, there's a lot of contention about diets and sugar gliders, and there's a lot of recommendations out there and bespoke diets and homemade diets. But essentially, 50 to 60%, so just under half of their diet should be a good variety of insects, and commercial pelleted food would be fine as well. So again, a cat food, preferentially a dry food. There are insectivore diets out there, but if there's difficulty obtaining that, then a dry cat food can work okay. Nectars, saps, and gums should be an important part of their diet as well. They do benefit from that as an important part of their diet, getting those carbohydrates. Egg can make up an easy source of protein. And the rest of their diet should be just a variety of mixed vegetables. No fruits at all. That's going to be too sugary. They'll be prone to diarrhea, diabetes, obesity. So no fruits. Very, very small amount of cooked meats are fine. And again, we recommend a vitamin and mineral supplement because they can be prone to metabolic bone disease. So if you can sprinkle on a general vitamin mineral supplement onto their diet once daily, that would be lovely. Sugar gliders are a little bit less tractable than Tenrex. They tend to be flighty. Even the best handled ones are skittish. So you can see in this photo on the left, luckily this little sugar glider is just sitting on the arm, but quickly decides it wants to be elsewhere. So just be prepared if you have them in hand that you've got the doors closed, there's no access points for them, they won't jump on the ground and hurt themselves or fall or hit a table edge. Just make sure you are able to contain them safely. Ideally, sugar gliders would have a little pouch that they could go into when they're stressed. Most sugar glider owners will be aware that they like pouches. It makes sense, doesn't it? They're marsupials. But it's an easy way to handle them, to transport them, to keep them warm and quiet and stress-free in transition. And if the owner's brought in a pouch, that sugar glider will be used to the smells of it, and you could utilize it to facilitate your examination. So you can see this little sugar glider's just beelining it for its pouch, its area of safety to get away from a bit of a stressful situation, which is our clinical exam. Some specific health concerns when it comes to sugar gliders, they're really prone to drama. You can imagine as they're jumping around, gliding about, moving here and there. They do have fragile skin. Their patagium can be fragile, and their toes and fingers are fragile, so they can traumatize themselves. We also see penile prolapse with them as well. I've already mentioned the nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism, or the metabolic bone disease. In the wild, we tend to see a lot of bacterial diseases that owners should be aware of because they're zoonotic, so mycobacteriosis, yersiniosis, Yersinia pestis, and pasteurilosis. Neoplasia can be common. We tend to see it at sites of chronic inflammation. So those paracloacal glands that I mentioned before, as those are enlarging and receding over the breeding seasons year on, year out, that could potentially be a site of chronic inflammation. And there have been reports of neoplasia of the paracloacal glands of sugar gliders. Candida overgrowth. So marsupials are very sensitive to antibiotics, and if you have a sugar glider on long-term antibiotic use, You might want to keep an eye out for candida overgrowth, or keep your antibiotic course as short as possible, or aim for the lowest dose, or maybe think about modifying diet a bit. Anything you can do to prevent candida overgrowth. So that was a little bit of a run through sugar gliders, and now we're on to chipmunks. So the next two species, the chipmunks and the prairie dogs, are both rodent species, so there'll be a lot of similarities between the two and what we're talking about, but I'll try to highlight the differences. A lot of just typical rodent knowledge will apply. Really, they are a member of the Sciuridae family. The pet chipmunk that we tend to see as exotic pets is usually the Siberian chipmunk, and they're native to Asia, obviously. There is a North American chipmunk as well, but they don't tend to be seen as pets very frequently. Chipmunks keep much more sociable hours, so they're not nocturnal species, they're more diurnal, so we'll be able to be enjoying their behavior during our daytime, they won't be stressed by our activity during the day as much as the tenrec or the sugar gliders might be. And so again, that might make a difference, the determination of where you put their enclosure. They do hibernate, but kind of when it suits them, really, and they tend to really just gain weight during this period rather than going into a torpor. They put weight on when the light cycle decreases and the temperature decreases, but for captive house chipmunks, we might not notice this so much. It'll be much more obvious in ones that are wild, or if they're housed in a naturalistic type exhibit, perhaps outdoors or supported outdoors, and you might see this permissive hibernation behavior. Much more social than the tenrec and the sugar gliders are, so they enjoy being in groups. Can live quite a long time for a rodent species. Again, this is a difference between captive housing and supported captive care and supported care that we can provide with good nutrition and housing versus in the wild. So that's why that massive range comes from. In the wild, they're often living 2 to 5 years, but it's up to 10 years in captivity. Reaching sexual maturity, just under a year of age. Gestation's about a month, similar to other rodents. Smaller litter size compared to other rodents, and a similar age at weaning. Just like rodents, the determination between boys and girls will be the same. So you'll have an increased anogenital distance in boys and that rounder genital papilla compared to the V-shaped one in females. And females will have typically think of it as three openings. So their urinary and reproductive tracts come out at separate orifices, and then they'll have their rectum as well. So you'll have three openings in a female and two in a male. And again, not too many anatomical differences. We kind of all know about rodents, really. It's just to remind you that the males do have an open inguinal canal, so that'll make a little bit of changes if you're doing castrations. And then I've added in their dental formula. Housing will be similar to the sugar gliders without all of the gliding space, but they do enjoy tall cages. You can use more mesh than what I was describing with the sugar gliders in doing a vertical bars, but you can use more of a mesh style caging system for them. They'll really enjoy logs to run on, perches to run on, things to jump across, nest boxes and hollows and burrows and things to scrabble in. So, typical kind of rodent things, really. They would really enjoy deep bedding for digging. And again, this can be, there's a variety of options out there, but shredded paper would just be the easiest, really, and the cleanest and the least likely to transmit disease or illness. But it's very important that wherever they are, it's well ventilated and that we can maintain a kind of a sensible light dark cycle. So 14 hours of light and 10 hours of dark is what we recommend. And again, that's because they're diurnal and they would just benefit from that kind of schedule. A typical rodent diet would be absolutely fine for them. And so you can provide a chipmunk complete diet or a small rodent complete diet, as well as a small amount of dried vegetables and fruits and nuts. So just a small amount of dry. These won't necessarily be fresh. And then they'll enjoy eating some grasses, so a variety of fescue or Bermuda grasses, and then some timothy hay. That's always easy to get. So a bit of timothy hay would be lovely for them to nibble on, and then also nice for them to scrabble about in and dig about in. Hopefully you've got a well-handled chipmunk like this little one on the left, who's obviously really used to handling and coming out and about. If not, then use that typical rodent restraint technique where you're holding them around the shoulders and the pelvic girdle in order to perform a good physical exam while keeping yourself safe. Some people like to use gloves. There are lots of different kinds of gloves out there, from heavy-duty Kevlar mesh-style gloves to prevent teeth injury to smaller leather gloves or gardening gloves. Some people choose not to wear gloves at all because they feel like it prevents them from holding properly. So whatever your choice, just make sure you're practicing good hygiene, you're aware of your surroundings, you're not being distracted while you're holding them, so you stay safe from injury as well. Being a rodent, they have those kind of typical rodent health concerns also. So the dental disease, as we've highlighted with the Tenrex and the sugar gliders, can happen in chipmunks as well. They can have incisor overgrowth secondary to not having enough things to gnaw on or chew on. So it is really important for them to have that as part of their diet. They can also present with signs of pyometra or pneumonia like other rodent species might do. And just to make you aware so you can relay to owners, chipmunks in the wild are transmitters of yersiniosis. And so it's just something to be aware of given the zoonotic potential. And now we're on to prairie dogs. So our last of the four species that we're going to be talking about today, and again, another rodent species like the chipmunks. So a lot of what I've talked about for chipmunks will apply to the prairie dogs as well. And I'll just try to highlight any specific differences. So this is a prairie dog. They tend to be the black-tailed prairie dogs that we have in captivity. And this is the same that you might see in zoos and indeed what people have found to be nice pets as well. They're native to North America. Again, a diurnal rodent species, so more sociable hours, again with the permissive hibernating, and they're even more social than the other species I've chatted about before. In fact, they can form really nice social bonds with their owners if they're just a small number of prairie dogs in the household, or they can form large social groups if housed in large groups. Now, just to be aware that as they reach sexual maturity or social hierarchies develop, we can see some infighting, and so it might be a good idea to keep same-sex social groups together, not only to prevent that fighting, but also to cut down on breeding behaviors if that's what an owner wants to stay away from. But again, they tend to make fair enough pets. They do bond to the owners, and therefore that means they might be a little bit more handleable when they come in to see you for a clinical exam. Lifespan is really similar to the chipmunks. They reach sexual maturity very early, though, 2 to 3 months of age. So it's really important to be able to determine the sex of male and female prairie dogs so that you can separate them as soon as possible into same-sex groups to prevent breeding. Gestation is about the same, so about a month. Litter size is about the same as well. And age at weaning is a little bit extended, so around 6 weeks of age. Again, being a rodent, they'll have that typical sex determination of the increased anogenital distance in the boys and that rounder genital papilla, whereas the females have more of a V-shaped. And the females will have the three openings again, so their urinary tract, their reproductive tract, and then their rectum. Some specific differences, just to highlight again that they've got the open inguinal canals in case you're performing a castration, but also that they don't have any distinct scrotal sac. So that means that you might have to do an abdominal castration, an abdominal approach for that, given that we can't go in scrotally. And they do, both sexes of prairie dogs have a trigonal anal sac, which is just a scent gland next to their anus that has a little bit of projections on it with a little bit of white material. And again, I've added the dental formula just so you have it to hand, just in case dental disease becomes a problem in any prairie dog patients that you have. Housing's going to be a little bit more intense compared to the chipmunks. So a lot of the same things will apply in terms of deep bedding for digging, but even deeper. And you might want to think about advising a concrete-lined enclosure for your owners. Certainly a metal one like the chipmunks, but you might have to go even farther than that, depending on how much the prairie dog is digging. They're just avid diggers. That's just what they want to spend most of their time doing, and so they really need to think about being able to accommodate for that in their housing scenario. Burrows, nest boxes, and hollows they'll benefit from as well. And again, the same other issues in terms of good ventilation and a day length for them as was with the chipmunks. Their diet is a little bit different in that it focuses more heavily on the grasses. So it should be the vast proportion of their diet should be timothy hay or Bermuda grasses and fescue. This little prairie dog is really enjoying its hay. And then a small amount of fresh greens and rodent diet. So literally maybe just a cube of rodent diet once a day or a few times a week. So just a small proportion of that as their diet, where primarily they're eating the hays. They are very, very prone to obesity, and so this will really help with that problem as well as help with their dental health as well. Obviously, they do enjoy other things like little insect treats and things like that, but it's not to be encouraged as a major part or even a consistent part of their diet. As I mentioned before, handling might be a little bit easier because the prairie dogs tend to be more social than the other species we've chatted about earlier. So you might have a cute little prairie dog present to you in consultation like this, popping its head out of a carrier, in which case you could probably restrain it just like a little bit more active guinea pig, really. And again, you can see we're utilizing that shoulder and pelvic girdle hold that you typically use for a rodent to keep your hands safe from teeth. But they tend to be handled fine. If they're handled fine at home, it's just perhaps you're presented with a prairie dog that's not handled well at home or not handled frequently at all. Perhaps it's fairly hands-off and kind of a natural exhibit outside, or perhaps it's injured or stressed and it's just acting abnormally, in which case you might need to handle it with a towel to prevent it from biting. You just gently place a towel over its head, or indeed you might need to go perform a little bit of an anesthetic in order to examine it properly. Similar to the chipmunks, they are prone to trauma because they are diggers and scrabblers, and so they might have injuries secondary to that, whether it's entrapment or cutaneous ulcerations or superficial wounds. They are also prone to getting upper respiratory tract disease like a pasteurosis, and then that dental disease that we mentioned as well. They can get a condition called pseudo-odontoma, which is something we see in other species, but we tend to see it a little bit more frequently in prairie dogs. And the idea is that they've got an overgrowth of this kind of tooth-like tissue in their oral cavities that might present as a mass or a swelling, a firm mass that might need resection. And we think that this potentially is related to repeated trauma in the mouth due to inappropriate diet, or perhaps due to chewing on inappropriate things in their enclosure. Obesity, we mentioned, that's why it's so important to keep to a diet that focuses on hays primarily, and they're prone to pyometrics. Thought I'd also mention again that in the wild we tend to see prairie dogs suffering from yersiniosis, so it's just important to let your owners know about zoonotic risk. So that's our quick run through the specifics of each of those four, the tenrecs, the sugar gliders, the chipmunks, and the prairie dogs. And now we'll just talk about general techniques for all of them together. So not only IV access, but a little bit of anesthesia, just so you can be very thorough in clinical examination, diagnostics, and hopefully coming up with a diagnostic plan and prognosis for your patient. Now, IV access might be difficult given the size. You obviously might have to have this animal under anesthesia to give an IV injection, or choose a medication that you can give subcutaneously or intramuscularly. But if you are going for the IV route, then the cephalic vein or the saphenous vein would be your option. Prairie dogs are large enough that you might be able to get an auricular vein, similar to in chinchillas, so hopefully that would be an option for you. Intraosseous sites are similar to other species, so the top of the femur, tibial crest, and the humerus are all options for intraosseous catheters and also administration of medications. IV collection sites, again, similar to other exotic species that we know, like the guinea pig and chinchilla, ferret, and squirrel monkeys, things like that. So cranial vena cava is an option in these species. The femoral vein, cephalic vein, lateral tail, and saphenous again. And perhaps a jugular and a prairie dog, they're going to be large enough that you should be able to palpate a jugular. If it is an obese animal, though, you won't be able to palpate it. If it's a very critical animal, you'll need to perform a cut down under anesthesia, or if it's collapsed with local anesthetic. In certain times of year in breeding season, perhaps males might have a little bit of thicker skin and make it a little bit more difficult to get through the skin with your needle at that site around the neck as well. Anesthetic considerations are similar to our other small exotic species. Just to reiterate that we don't recommend fasting them at home, so we don't have to advise that the owner does that before a general anesthetic. But after you have it admitted and you've given it a good examination and you're monitoring it prior to general anesthetic, that's when you can perform your fast. Or if it's been an emergency, it might have been off food anyway, or it might have taken that hour time to get it in after consultation and admission, and that hour's passed. So the owner won't have to fast at home, just simply pulling food an hour before Performing your anesthetic should be absolutely fine. We do like to give analgesia ahead of time, and there's lots of typical doses out there for exotic species. We can use the routine medications for that. We preemptively give analgesia because a lot of these species are just really high stress species, high stress prey species with elevated catecholamine levels that might be sensitizing heart muscles. And so by giving analgesia ahead of time, you're hopefully breaking that cycle a little bit and making them as comfortable as possible, but also preventing self-mutilation, which species like prairie dogs are prone to doing. So we want to do everything we can to try to not make that something you have to worry about. Just like with other small exotic species, we are pre-warming them prior to anesthesia and pre-oxygenating as well. So this little prairie dog's been placed in an induction chamber. It's easy to set that induction chamber on a little heat mat to pre-warm, or if you've got an incubator in your practice, you can just admit the small animal and place it right in an incubator so it's nicely pre-warmed, and then move on to your anesthetic once you're ready. So you can see you might want to do perform an anesthetic for a number of reasons, whether it's just a routine examination, or for instance looking in the mouth of this prairie dog, or performing diagnostics. The usual chamber that you might have for doing this in your practice is absolutely fine. If you have a smaller species you're working with, you might want to add a towel to decrease the dead space in that chamber, and it also provides a nice little hide area for that animal while it's being induced with anesthetic. Maintaining it on a face mask will be absolutely fine for short procedures, and certainly in some species we don't have the option to intubate. You can see we've just used a face mask as an induction chamber in the sugar glider. And instead of using a face mask to maintain it, we're just using a little bit of an addition to the end of the tubing that fits over its nose a little bit better so that it can have its CT performed as in this lower picture. We tend to use inhalation anesthesia, whether that's isoflurane or sevoflurane, whatever's to hand, primarily in these exotic species. Now, there are lots of doses out there for injectable pre-medication, but to be honest, a lot of these protocols have been developed for animals in the wild and might not necessarily be needed for our pet species. Certainly, they'll be coming to us in a carrier. They'll be used to being handled to some extent or another, and so popping them in a little induction chamber, that's kind of a stress-free scenario, is usually very, very doable. We're usually not needing to inject them with any injectable premedications. And given the predictability of inhalation anesthetics like isoflurane and sevoflurane, we feel that that's a very safe alternative. Prairie dogs, you can intubate, usually otoscope guided. There have been blind techniques described as well, similar to rabbits. You'll just need a very small tube, a 2 to 2.5 tube that's uncuffed, and just ensure that you're clearing the mouth out before you're doing this so that you're not pushing food material down the trachea. And then we also advise using a non-rebreathing anesthetic circuit that has a low dead space and resistance, such as a Bain's and an Ayers T piece. So again, these are pretty similar considerations that you'd be applying from your knowledge with other exotic small mammals as well. All the same things apply. Really, I wanted to highlight during this webinar the differences in husbandry, so diet and housing, and the differences in anatomy that will affect your approach to the clinical exam and potentially affect your approach to anesthesia and treatment. What you'll also need to think about is how your owner is going to treat your animal at home. Are they going to be able to be compliant with what you're asking? Are they going to be able to hide a bit of medication in a food item? What's the best food item to do that in? Will the owner need to really amp up their handling and just provide that medication via syringe orally? So hopefully that's given you some good tips and how to successfully approach your unusual exotic mammal. I've added just a few references to the end here. You can have a look through. These are good quality references. And again, hopefully that's been a good run through of these unusual species, which I thought would be good today, which were the chipmunk, the tenrec, and the prairie dog, and the sugar glider. And just to answer a couple questions, it looks like we've got a little bit of time. A question: do these species make suitable pets? Well, it really depends on how they're handled and the I suppose interest of the owner. Now, some owners really just want to have them as kind of a naturalistic kind of exotic species that they can maintain, and some really want that kind of more direct interaction. So I'd say out of the four that we've talked about today, the tenrecs can be really docile, especially given their nocturnal nature. So when we're handling them during the day, they can be really easily handled and be lovely little pets. They don't tend to bite like some of the other species. And the prairie dogs, again, like I mentioned before, the prairie dogs can be really nicely social and bond to the owner, so they can make good pets. And then just another last quick, just to reiterate, providing UV to these species. We do recommend it in a lot of small exotic species, and we certainly would recommend it in the ones that we see clinical signs of metabolic bone disease in, which would be the sugar gliders. So if even though they are a nocturnal species, providing some UV, and again making sure that UV light is changed out every 6 months so that we're having predictable, dependable UV emitted, would be a good way to help prevent metabolic bone disease from being an issue in your exotic species. So hopefully that's been a good run through for the unusual exotic pet mammal. Hope you've enjoyed the webinar, and thank you for your time.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Bronwyn for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.